You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
Does your party and your coalition have a problem of Islamophobia, given that track record of behaviour?
Well, I already said to you before that, no, I don't think the party has a problem. I don't think the Liberal Party as a total group has that problem. No, I don't. And I don't think the National Party does either.
Australia's Prime Minister undergoes a roughing up on television as the country debates its treatment of Muslims following last week's terrorist attack in neighbouring New Zealand. Also ahead, US President Donald Trump adopts a strangely relaxed attitude to the prospect of Robert Mueller's presumed imminent final report going public. Possibly a silly question, but does Trump know something? We'll have the latest from Brazil, where another former president is consuming jailhouse gruel. We'll hear from Taiwan's president as she seeks to recover from recent setbacks, and we'll review the morning papers on America's West Coast. All that and more ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It's not news that Washington, D.C. and the wider watching world is agog with anticipation of the release of the report by former FBI Director Robert Mueller into possible interference by Russia in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and collusion with the winner thereof. Washington, D.C. and the wider watching world have been agog with anticipation for Mueller's report since about 30 seconds after the investigation began in May 2017. However, and with all due acknowledgement of the perils of wishful thinking, an assumption appears to be gathering that the report will be submitted to Attorney General William Barr sooner rather than later. Nobody outside the investigation has any idea what will be in the report. Mueller has run a notably tight ship, but a ringing endorsement of the probity of President Donald Trump seems unlikely. The question dangling is, what might anything less than that mean? Well, I'm joined now by Suzanne Lynch, the Irish Times Washington, D.C. correspondents. Suzanne, as I said, we don't know quite when Mueller is going to release his report, nor do we know quite what's going to be in it. But do we have any idea from a political perspective what level of discredit Trump could reasonably expect to ride out?
Well, it all depends on the breadth and the scope of this report. People will remember the last big impeachment case, which was the Clinton scandal in the 90s, when Kenneth Starr was a special counsel. And he filed a huge hundreds and hundreds of pages of report that was nicely bound and published, in which he provided essentially a narrative of what he'd been investigating, including lurid details of the then president's sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. And this is not going to happen this time. Since Kenneth Starr did his work, the rules have changed. And there has been a new special counsel regulation, if you like, which gives us an insight into what kind of report we should expect. It is likely to be much more constrained, much shorter. What we do know is that the special counsel is obliged to provide the Attorney General with what they say is a confidential report explaining any prosecution decisions it's reached. And then the Attorney General has a decision about whether to make that public, to send it to Congress, to make it public, etc. So it's probably not going to have that same kind of impact we saw with Kenneth Starr. But in saying that, this is the first time there's been a report of this scale, really, since the Clinton years. So Robert Mueller himself has a lot of leeway in what he can do with this report.
So I guess to ask a similar question from the opposite direction, do we have any idea, or have any congressional Democrats especially given any indication of how bad it would need to be before they would be impelled to act, which would obviously mean moving in the first instance articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, and this is the key issue, right, Andrew? I mean, essentially, whatever happens with the report, the president is protected. He cannot be indicted while in office. Now, there is a lot of debate here about interpreting those rules, but essentially he can't. He's protected. The only way to remove a president is through impeachment, and that becomes a political decision. And there's a phrase, a colloquial phrase, which basically says, you know, impeachment is what the House of Representatives believes impeachment should be. There's a lot of leeway And it's a political decision about what constitutes an impeachable offence, as we saw with the Clinton impeachment. So this will ultimately be a matter of for Congress. So Robert Mueller's role here is not to judge whether Donald Trump should be impeached or not. What he will find out, and what we do expect him to disclose, is maybe prosecution decisions about other characters in this saga, if you like. We know, for example, that he was looking at the meeting in Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, etc., with Russian individuals. We know he's been looking and has interviewed Michael Flynn. We know he's interviewed Jeff Sessions. So these other figures are also going to be in this report. And that's nothing to do with impeachment, if you like, how it reflects upon them. But ultimately, it will be up to Democrats, really, to gauge the public appetite for impeachment. Yes, they may want to, you know, they may have the right, essentially, or judge they have the right to push through impeachment. But I think if they feel the public is not with them, they may not go down that route. The second problem is the Senate is in control of Republican hands. So it would want to be a very, very serious issue to make Republicans break with their president and vote to remove him from office.
I mean, is it possible? And I guess it is possible because it's an outcome that certainly House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has hinted at, that even if it is bad, verging on damning, that the Democrats might take the view that from their point of view, from a, and as you say, it's a political decision, they might just be better off leaving him there. There being maybe, you know, a little less than 2 years of his presidency still to run. And if they think he is the proverbial lame duck president and on course to be roundly thumped at the ballot box, that it makes more sense just to let the electorate make the decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the danger is that if they move to impeachment, that you will have a lot of the country who believe Donald Trump's rhetoric that this thing was a witch hunt, that essentially politically motivated. So polls have shown that Donald Trump's constant attack on the validity of the Mueller investigation have worked to an extent. Less people support the work of the Mueller investigation than they did at the beginning. So there is a fear among Democrats that this could backfire on them. And significantly, just literally within the last hour, James Comey has written a piece, the former FBI director who was fired by Donald Trump. He's written a piece in the New York Times saying he doesn't want, essentially, Donald Trump to be impeached, making this point exactly that, look, Mueller needs to do his work, but the job of Mueller is not to see whether he's impeached or not. And he believes exactly what you said there, that the best way to kind of deal with Donald Trump is to let the electoral process play out, go back to the polls in 2020 and re-elect someone else. So I think that is a very significant school of thought at the moment. But of course, you know, we don't know what's in this report. There could be something hugely damning. And if there was, well, then I think we could see a change attack on that argument.
It's always of debatable utility, obviously, investing too much in the public pronouncements of Donald Trump. We are very familiar by now with the fact that he does just tend to say whatever pops into his head at a given moment. But he has, in the last couple of days especially, made a couple of statements sounding weirdly relaxed about the prospect of the Mueller report being made public. Is that something we think we can set any store in at all, or is he just, as he so often is, saying stuff?
I know. Well, look, there are a lot of suspicions about his motivation. As you say, he said in a very relaxed way on Wednesday, I don't mind if the Mueller report is made public. No one quite knows why he's saying this. You know, does he know something we don't? It's adding to the sense that this thing really could be imminent. But we do have to say that this week in particular, I must say, Donald Trump has issued the most kind of bizarre comments on Twitter and in public. I'm thinking particularly of his tirade against the late John McCain. He has consistently and continually attacked him in public comments and on Twitter, and also at a rally in Ohio on Wednesday, which really fell flat with the audience there. So there is a sense that Donald Trump is particularly kind of out of bounds at the moment in terms of his public statements and his public pronouncements. Perhaps the statement was just a throwaway mark in that context. As you say, I would be inclined to say it's very difficult to read that statement, to put much store in it. But it is adding to the sense that something is coming here, and that the release of this document, which will go in the first instance to the Attorney General, is imminent in some way.
Well, just finally then, and I guess it's the question that the Democrats will be asking themselves, is there any indication that, and you're quite right to refer to his peculiar protracted tantrum of last weekend, which was bizarre even by his formidable standards, is there any sign that any of this stuff is actually changing any minds whatsoever in Trump's base? Or is it in fact arguable that it's just solidifying their resolve even more?
Yeah, I mean, this is the key question now is how bad do things have to get before this supporters start deserting Donald Trump? I think the thing to watch and what could spell trouble for Donald Trump is that if there is something very damning in this about possible collusion with Russia, well, then you may see some senior Republicans beginning to part ways with the president. And that could spell trouble. They may bring their supporters with them. People like Lindsey Graham, who stood by the president on certain issues. Even people like Mitch McConnell. And you're going to have figures like Mitt Romney, people who've already started breaking with him at some point, on some issues. If there's something in this report that even they, you know, this is the Republican Party is supposed to be the hard-edged foreign policy, tough guy party when it comes to foreign policy. And if there is suggestion that there's any collusion with Putin, you may see some senior Republicans breaking with Trump. And as I say, that could spell trouble for the president, because if he loses the support of the institution of the Republican Party, that could trickle down and that could really spell trouble for him.
Suzanne Lynch with the Irish Times in Washington, D.C. Thanks as always. You're listening to The Daily. Here are some of the other stories we're keeping an eye on today. At least 70 people are believed dead after a ferry sank in the Tigris River in Mosul. The boat had more than 200 people aboard when it capsized en route to the island of Umrabayan, upstream from Mosul city centre. It was hosting celebrations observing Nowruz, the Kurdish New Year. Local authorities had recently warned of heightened water levels in the Tigris following the opening of the Mosul dam. US President Donald Trump has made another helpful intervention in the Middle East, helpful at least to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, presently seeking re-election. In a tweet containing words, syntax, historical knowledge and strategic understanding that suggested an amount of ghostwriting, Trump said it was time that the United States recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which Israel captured from Syria during the Six-Day War of 1967 and has occupied ever since. And UK Prime Minister Theresa May is in Brussels for what seems like the 100th time this week alone, speaking to clearly baffled EU leaders in a bid to extricate the UK from the self-dug hole in which it presently resides. May is seeking a delay to the current scheduled Brexit date of March 29th, but EU leaders seem, as we go to air, unkeen on any delay that would necessitate the UK contesting EU elections in late May. They are grievously underestimating the potential comedy value. As things presently stand, unless someone decides otherwise, the UK will crash out of the EU without a deal after nearly 3 years of inane bickering in 1 week and about 45 minutes. This is the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. It's almost exactly a week since a terrorist murdered 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. On the other side of the Tasman Sea in Australia, the attack has prompted the proper amount of shock and grief, but also an argument about the way that Australia's Muslims have long been regarded by Australian politicians and reported by Australian media. At the centre of this row have been the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who has been forced to defend past documented and alleged comments of his own, and Waleed Ali, the academic and television presenter who is probably Australia's most prominent Muslim. The two men met on the programme Ali co-hosts, Channel 10's The Project. Well, I'm joined from Canberra by Karen Middleton, chief political correspondent for the Saturday paper. Karen, this goes back, I guess, to Waleed Ali's monologue, very emotional and quite understandably so in the immediate aftermath of the shootings in Christchurch. For the benefit of our international listeners, can you give us a bit of the gist of what he said and how it led to this confrontation with the Prime Minister?
Yes, he reflected with great sadness on what had happened in Christchurch, and he talked about Islamophobia in Australia and elsewhere, but particularly in Australia. He opened up by saying, "You'll have to forgive me, these won't be my best words," which indicated there was a degree of an emotion and personal investment in the issue for him. But he pointed back to news reports from 2011 that alleged that the the now Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, when he was a member of the shadow cabinet and shadow immigration minister, I think at that time, he allegedly said in a shadow cabinet meeting that they should capitalise on anti-Muslim sentiment. Now, those reports have been around for 7 years, 8 years now. He didn't object vehemently to them at the time, but Waleed Ali mentioned them again and was very direct in his criticism of the now Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister's office threatened to sue him over them. He denied the reports, said that they weren't true at the time and they weren't true now, and was very agitated about it. And that might have something to do with the fact that Waleed Ali's monologue, as of this moment, has had 4.16 million views on Twitter. So it's got a fair airing far and wide.
Do we know how this interview set up? Was it something Waleed Ali wanted to do or something Scott Morrison wanted to do, if he thought it was perhaps a more intelligent way of getting his case across than threatening lawsuits against journalists?
Well, it's an interesting question and one that I haven't clarified yet. I'm not sure how well it came off for the Prime Minister, but he obviously is concerned at the reach of that monologue. And Waleed Ali is a very popular figure in Australia. He's won Australia's highest popular television award for TV presenter, the Gold Logie, at one point. So he's a well-known and well-loved figure in Australia. And so to have someone like that criticise the Prime Minister would obviously be a concern for him. And it's very unusual for the project, the TV program, to do the kind of interview they did last night. It's a panel television show. It's a news and current affairs and entertainment show. So it's a sort of infotainment, I guess. It does cover some gritty news and current affairs issues, but in an accessible way. I do some commentary for it myself, I should disclose. But they don't often have a one-on-one interview. It's usually the whole panel. So for them to sit down one-on-one with the Prime Minister and commercial-free, because it airs on the 10 network, which is a commercial network, is very unusual.
I have watched the interview, and it struck me as a robust, I think it's fair to say, but mostly fairly respectful encounter. I think both Ali and Morrison gave reasonable accounts of themselves in getting their points across. Do you have a sense of how it played with the Australian public?
Well, it's certainly being widely reported today. I suppose it's not really clear yet what the public reaction has been. We'll need to listen to some of the feedback on Talkback Radio today, Australian time, to get a sense of whether people have paid a lot of attention to it yet and what they think. But obviously the Prime Minister made a decision in going on that program, whether or not it was his instigation or Waleed Ali's instigation, that it was an important thing for him to do. So he obviously felt he had a message to convey. I would imagine he thinks he conveyed that well. He did confirm in that interview that there was a discussion about Muslim sentiment towards Muslims in Australia back in 2011, but he insists that he did not suggest it should be capitalised on. Now, a number of other journalists have reported subsequent to that original report, which was by Lenore Taylor, who is now editor of Guardian Australia, but at the time was working for the Sydney Morning Herald. Subsequently, there have been reports by other journalists, also all very credible. And I must say, Lenore is a personal friend of mine, but also an award-winning and very fine journalist. Those other reports have backed in the original report. And so, there's some debate about the veracity of those reports around, but I think in journalistic circles and in those who consume news media, there's an acceptance that these are very credible journalists with credible sources. And people reporting it at the moment are saying those sources, or sources who were in the room, are still saying, some people are saying it was said, some people are saying it wasn't. So it's still the subject of debate.
The interview we're talking about, of course, appears in the context of what I know has been a fairly wide-ranging discussion in Australia over the last week or so since that attack in New Zealand. And I guess in Australia it was prompted most obviously not so much of the attack by the attack itself, but by the sensationally idiotic response of Senator Fraser Anning, who turned himself into an instant global superstar, and not in a good way, and didn't do wonders for Australia's reputation in the process. Is it your sense that any of this conversation has generated any light as opposed to heat, as this usually does?
Yes, I think there is a lot of reflection in Australia about whether or not we're paying enough attention collectively, and particularly our security agencies, to right-wing extremism, to the kinds of views that are being allowed to flourish online. The Prime Minister has contacted Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, who's the current chair of the G20, and asked that the issue of social media companies' responsibility be placed on the agenda for the next meeting, because of the fact that this video was live streamed on Facebook, and so there's a serious push there. But there's also a debate in Australia now about the language our political leaders use and what has become normalised, what passes for free speech. So it's interesting timing in that sense. I mean, it's a tragedy all round, absolutely horrific, and that's also being acknowledged. The shock is being felt here as well. But it's interesting timing, there being an election coming up here in Australia shortly, and immigration often being used as an election weapon, and issues of diversity and cohesion, social cohesion. And I think there will be some moderation in that debate now as a result of this terrible incident.
Well, you're quite right to raise the election, which is imminent, and you're also quite right to point out that immigration is a reliably weather-beaten political football in Australia. Do you get the sense that maybe, and not that there's much in the way of consolation to be wrung from something like what happened in Christchurch, but maybe it might result in Australia and maybe other countries thinking about this in a slightly less cranky way?
Oh, I would like to say yes. I hope that that is the case. I think there are still parts of Australia where concern about immigration flourishes. I mean, in the middle of all this week, the federal government, Prime Minister Morrison, did announce cuts to our immigration intake, new government policy, which he said were necessary to alleviate congestion in big cities. So he's been careful how he couches that, but certainly immigration remains still a hot button issue in some areas. I think it will change the tone of the debate, and hopefully that's more than just temporary. Whether it changes it permanently or whether it dissuades those who still hold those views of concerns about Muslim presence in Australia and immigration, I have my doubts, unfortunately. But I think there are plenty of people saying they feel like this event being so close to home, and with the alleged perpetrator of it being an Australian, is a kind of a tipping point on this issue, and that perhaps there'll be more serious discussion about it in future.
Karen Middleton with the Saturday Paper, thank you for joining us from Canberra. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Up next, our Hong Kong bureau chief meets the president of Taiwan.
For a global perspective and some fresh ideas direct to your door on business, culture and design, not to mention fashion, travel and much more, subscribe today and join the world of Monocle. As a valued subscriber, you'll get a 10% discount in all Monocle shops and our online store. You'll also be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events and have full access to the magazine archives. In addition, all one-year subscriptions come with a free limited edition Monocle tote bag. With four bespoke subscription packages to choose from, you decide what suits you and your lifestyle best. What are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has endured a tough few months. Her ruling Democratic Progressive Party suffered heavy defeats in November's midterm elections. Her popularity in the polls has plummeted, and mainland China has been applying the usual thumbscrews. But can she bounce back? Monocle's James Chambers spoke to her in the Taiwanese capital, Taipei, as part of an in-depth interview for this month's edition of Monocle magazine.
Since you were elected, the kind of global political landscape has changed somewhat by President Trump in the US. I was speaking to a young Taiwanese guy last night. He's a designer, he's very liberal, in his 30s. He voted for you in 2016. And when I asked him, is he going to vote for you next year, he said no. He's going to vote for Mayor Kerr. And I was asking him why, and he said because he likes his politicians to have more guts. So what I wanted to know from you is that in this post-Trump era, looking ahead to 2020, do you feel like you need to be a bit more Trump?
Yeah.
Or are you going to stick to your guns and stay true to who you are?
It depends on how you define political guts. By now, I think people think that despite I use softer language when I express issues, despite I'm a woman, but I am a very determined person and I am prepared to do things despite the political cost that is involved. And this is what a leader should be. It's not a matter of speaking tough, it's a matter of whether you are determined enough to complete a reform. In the process, you get attacks, you get pressures, and you have lots of conflicts to deal with. But eventually, it's the result that you want to present to the people here.
As we gear up for the electioneering period for 2020, what would you say your top priorities are when it comes to, I guess, your core remit, foreign relations, cross-strait relations, and defence?
We have told the international community and countries in the region that we would be keeping the status quo. But given the changes in the environment, the status quo, when we're talking about status quo, we're talking about keeping the right kind of balance.
Yeah.
So we'll continue to keep the right kind of balance. We're not going to be provocative in our relationship with China. But we have to equip ourselves with sufficient defense capability given the Chinese large investment in their military development. So we need to increase our military capability, make Taiwan a more defendable place. It's our priority.
I know you're shifting the military towards a full volunteer service, or that's the goal. How is that going? When do you think that will be complete?
This policy has been initiated and carried out by the two former presidents. And so my job at the moment is to make this all-voluntary system work and also make our military defense capability improve as a result of this all-voluntary system. But the modern military situation is this, you need soldiers with experience and not know how to deal with high-tech weaponries. A lot of professional training required. So if we go back to this old system of military service, under which young men join the military for a year, and to us it's not enough. Today, with this all-voluntary system, a volunteer would join the military for at least 4 years, I think. That gives us enough time to train them. And after they retire from this four-year service, they can extend their services to a longer time, as soon as they're qualified. Receiving at least 4 years of training make them a very experienced soldier. So you have a core group of all voluntary professional soldiers, and you also have reserve groups, and they are primarily retirees from the voluntary services.
You've spoken a lot during your first term about beefing up Taiwan's domestic defense industry, building your own submarines. What would be your plan in that area for your second term?
Well, it's accumulation process and require a longer term effort. So this place in terms of industrial production or manufacturing is actually one of the best places in the world. And we do have that sort of manufacturing capability. And in terms of talents, R&D talents, we do have a lot. So combining the two together, we actually can make military weaponries, missiles, military vessels. Hopefully at some stage we'll be able to manufacture military aircraft all by ourselves.
Looking ahead to the election next year, some of your biggest critics would say that you only win if you play the China card. So if Beijing does something silly and you seize on it, rile people up, then the DPP will win. How do you respond to that?
The thing that people care about, of course, is the national security and whether we'll be able to maintain a stable relationship with China. I think people want to have that. So it's not a matter of speaking loud in a tough manner. Of course, sometimes you have to be loud and tough, but it's not the only thing that a leader should do. What we need to do is to make sure our national security is okay, and at the same time, we'll be able to maintain a stable relationship with China.
President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan speaking there to Monocle's James Chambers in Taipei. You can read that interview in full in the latest edition of Monocle magazine, which will be on all good newsstands today or today about. You are listening to The Daily. This is The Daily with me, Andrew Muller, and to Brazil, where it is time to cross yet another name off the list of as yet unarrested prominent politicians. Latest to have his collar felt is former President Michel Temer, who has been run in by Sao Paulo's finest as part of an investigation into corruption. The arrest is not unexpected. It had been widely supposed that one of the things Temer enjoyed most about being president was the immunity from prosecution that came with the job. Also taken in was Temer's former mining and Energy Minister Moreira Franco. Well, I'm joined now by Lucinda Elliott, Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent. Lucinda, do we know entirely clearly what former President Temer is going to be charged with?
Well, according to prosecutors, Andrew, Temer received a 1 million real bribe, so around 200,000 euros equivalent, in exchange for rewarding three companies a construction contract for the nuclear plant Angra 3. And the prosecutors said that Temer's criminal organisation, as they describe it, committed crimes including active and passive corruption, money laundering, fraudulent bidding processes, and some of the money supposedly went to one of Temer's daughters, Maristella, which she's used to renovate a house. And she's also been taken in for question. So the operation is, it's known as Operation Radioactivity. It's actually part, it's an ongoing investigation that's part of the huge Lava Jato or Operation Car Wash investigation that is Brazil's biggest ever.
I apologise to any listeners who may have caught a stifled snigger from me there. I do realise that this stuff just isn't funny, but this, I mean, this passed the description of merely ludicrous some years ago now. This is absurd. It's preposterous. How are Brazilians reacting at this point? Do they still get as angry as they ought to be about it, or are people just now starting to tune it out?
In some ways, yes, and others, no. I mean, this was one of, I mean, there were 11 other people arrested today by Rio investigators, including, as you said, the former energy minister and a governor of Rio de Janeiro, Moreira Franco, who was a close friend of Temer. And that makes him actually the fifth governor of the state of Rio to be arrested in recent years. I wouldn't say that people are immune to this, but as you can see, it's just this wave upon wave, and it's across the political spectrum as well.
Do these arrests, and I freely admit to having lost all track of who's connected to what at this point, do these arrests appear to have anything to do with the corruption scandals which enmeshed previous presidents like Lula da Silva, who ended up in prison, Dilma Rousseff, who ended up being impeached, or is this a whole other thing?
Well, this operation is slightly separate from the wider, as I said, the Operation Lava Jato, which is where everyone else is sort of interconnected. And as you say, it's quite a convoluted list. The first is former President Lula da Silva, who was detained in April of last year ahead of the 2018 election and is now serving a 12-year sentence for corruption and money laundering. Also, interestingly, it's linked to a flat that was renovated. He maintains his innocence, just as Temer has, and says that he's a political prisoner of a judiciary which overstepped its powers. And he still faces actually additional corruption trials, again, part of this much wiser system, although he's actually yet to exhaust the appeals process. A ruling that was made by a Supreme Court judge in Brazil meant that he's had to sit out his time in a federal prison to the south of the country. So it'll be interesting to see if the same rules apply with Temer. Then obviously we have Lula's Workers' Party successor, who was Dilma Rousseff. She was impeached for illegally fiddling with government accounts. It's slightly different. She essentially used money from state banks to bankroll public spending. And then Temer, who was her vice president at the time, from a different political party, is seen to have played quite a central role in the 2016 impeachment. You know, Dilma and her supporters from the Workers' Party described the whole impeachment process as a coup, and the involvement of Temer made him sort of a sworn enemy of the party. And then as for Temer, who took over from her, I mean, he was charged while president with a whole slew of crimes, again, all interconnected, including things like obstructions of justice, but has obviously up until this point managed to dodge an awful lot of these impeachment proceedings, thanks to his very strong alliances in Congress.
Have we had any input on this arrest from the current president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, whose line, successful as it proved to be on standing for election, that while he may be difficult to like on a number of other fronts, at least he wasn't on the take?
Yes, well, he was actually enjoying his 64th birthday today and notably not tweeting as yet about today's developments. Bolsonaro was about to do a Facebook Live, actually, as I came on air. But Temer's arrest, Brazilian media is noting, is actually a kind of welcome gift for Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro, popular disgust over what is seen as kind of endemic political corruption in Brazil, really helped fuel his rise. And he campaigned heavily on this anti-corruption pledge so far. There are no cases against him, although I'm certain critics will be mounting a case. But today really, very much plays into his rhetoric. Although what has also happened in recent months is there have been allegations made against Bolsonaro's son. So Flavio Bolsonaro, who is a senator here in Brazil, has been accused of making suspicious payments to a former driver of his. And some of those payments were made to the president's wife, the first lady, Michelle Bolsonaro, and that those payments were part of some sort of illicit form of campaign financing. But as a senator, Flavio, like Temer did, enjoys certain legal protection, including that any case involving him should basically be decided by a top court. So we're waiting on all of this.
Having listened to you say all that, I suspect I may know the answer to the question I'm about to ask, but it's a thing I think we do need to remind ourselves of, that this is not happening in some, irrelevant, obscure banana republic. Brazil is a huge and wealthy and powerful and extremely important country. And the situation that has occurred in its politics in recent years is just absurd. If ever there was a swamp that needed draining, this is it. Is there any indication as yet that Bolsonaro has even begun going about the clearly enormous structural reform which is required?
Well, I mean, this latest arrest is really seen as a coup, really, for anti-corruption activists, including the likes of Bolsonaro, who had feared that this entire car wash investigation could really lose momentum, because the former judge, Sergio Moro, who was spearheaded many of the cases, including the one against Lula, stepped down at the end of last year to become justice minister of Bolsonaro, which was seen as a very controversial move. When he stepped down, there was criticism that the whole thing would be watered down. Several commentators today actually said that this shows the operation, not only is it not partisan, but that the corrupt politicians have to be arrested. And so there is a move that will things be watered down or not? But this is seen as the way that the market is taking it, the way that people are reading it, is that this was a win today. I think what we do have to look out for is that actually earlier this month there were signs that it might be hurt in other ways. Brazil's Supreme Court ruled that corruption cases involving illegal campaign donations should be handled by electoral courts rather than having them heard by federal criminal courts. And these electoral courts are really not prepared to judge the more complex crimes such as money laundering and corruption. So some prosecutors are warning that we have to really be very, very careful when we're watching this, and there is a lot at stake.
Lucinda Elliott, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Now, on this week's edition of The Menu, Monocle 24's food and drink programme, we meet Alyssa Timoshkina, who has just released a book on the food of the former Soviet Union and especially her Siberian home. With the release of Salt and Thyme, as it's called, Alyssa wants to improve the reputation of Russian food. And as she demonstrates with her book, the culinary culture of this vast country is rich and varied and well worth discovering. A bit earlier, Alyssa spoke to Monocle's Marcus Hippie.
It happens so that I am from Siberia, and so my personal story is connected to that particular region. And then the region itself is quite interesting because it is a melting pot of different traditions and, in a way of East and West of Russia. So by focusing on Siberia and my own family, I was actually able to kind of tap into all different regions of Russia without hopefully kind of getting overwhelmed by the vastness of the place and the huge varieties of recipes and just the sheer amount of recipes that I needed to consider to include in the book. So it's quite a personal account with a bit of research here and there.
Let's look at your personal story then. So you grew up in Siberia. What did you eat over there? Can you paint a picture of, you know, what you had on the dinner table, for example, when you were younger?
Of course. Lots of soups. As we all know, Siberia is quite a cold place. So quite nice, hearty soups with bread and butter. Rye bread and butter were a complete must, especially in winter. Then obviously mashed potatoes is quite a homey, kind of nourishing meal that we had and still have. Lots of meat, yes, different stews, different soups, but also lots of ferments in winter because obviously there were no imported fresh fruit and vegetables. So people just had to preserve everything in the summer and early autumn. But then it's quite amazing to see how, you know, seasonality was really the main kind of way of eating back then. And during the summer, we would have a whole different range of dishes. There'd be lots of fresh herbs, lots of fresh vegetables, cold berry soups. Yeah, so it's quite a beautiful kind of way. You know, now it's very common to eat seasonally here in the UK, but it seems to be a very recent kind of trend or development in food culture, whereas in Russia and the Soviet Union, that was just a way of living naturally.
And I think it's also really interesting that besides getting the local produce, when you went to market squares, as you write in this book, you would actually find all these ingredients from all over the country.
Oh, yes, it was beautiful. I think the markets for me is a kind of childhood memory of the place where I grew up. It's probably the most vivid, most exciting place. And of course, there are so many negative things that we can say about the Soviet Union, but if we were to focus on something positive, then that kind of multicultural influence and multicultural just nature of each city that, you know, you could go to the market, especially in Siberia that is so close to Central Asia, and find herbs and spices from Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, also Georgian spices and food. And yeah, it's just absolutely incredible. And it was so much fun kind of seeing those huge piles of fresh herbs or nuts or dried kind of spice mixes.
Alisa, I know you did a fair bit of research for this book, and I know you also did some research on the culinary culture in Russia before the Soviet era. How much has Russian food changed then over the years? How much did, say, the Soviet era change food culture in Russia?
Oh, quite a lot. It's such a fascinating subject, and there's so many interesting books, kind of more on the academic side, that have been written about it. Obviously, the main difference between pre-Soviet and Soviet era is that food became less class-based. I have quite a few pre-revolutionary books, so from like late 18th century, and it's really fascinating how the recipes are assigned to specific class. So, you know, people of higher classes would obviously have a more kind of decadent meal with much more expensive ingredients, and people of lower classes would have a very limited, kind of quite monotone diet. So obviously when the Soviets started the revolution, the main thing was to get away with class, and that obviously translated into food. And if I were to kind of just define it as one main way of changing the food, that would be to obviously simplify it, because, you know, the new Soviet government had this huge task of feeding a huge country, but also through food, kind of creating this new sense of Soviet identity. So kind of inventing this new identity for a huge nation that was very diverse in religion and ethnicity. So they did create a more or less universe diet, which was, some of the dishes were actually based on pre-revolutionary dishes, but were simplified. Meat was often taken away, things like mayo, that's where the notorious mayonnaise makes its way into Russian cuisine. That was added to kind of bulk things up a bit and make it a lot easier to produce on mass scale. But also, interestingly, in the 30s, the Soviet commissar of food, as he was called, Anastas Mikoyan, he traveled to the States to kind of exchange the professional experience of mass food production. And he brought a few recipes back from the States. So the famous, which has now become a staple of Russian cuisine, a meat patty called kotleta, it's actually your standard beef burger patty that, you know, he brought over, but somehow along the way lost all the other elements of the burger. But it was only the patty that remained. Like every single Russian person would make patties at home, or you would have find them in school canteens, workers' canteens. You know, it truly became a national dish, which is quite funny to think that it actually has the roots in a classic American burger.
That was Alisa Timoshkina talking to Marcos Hippie about her new book, Salt and Time. You can hear the full episode of The Menu tomorrow night at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that and all our other programming anytime you like after that on our website, iTunes, and so forth. You are listening to The Daily. Up next, the West Coast newspapers.
When it comes to making friends and influencing others, smart nations know they need to show off their softer side. Join the Conga Line in our annual Soft Power Survey to find out where your nation stands. Playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
And it's time now on The Daily to take a look at the newspapers coming out of America's West Coast. It's mid-morning there in Los Angeles, from where we are joined from Monocle's Los Angeles Bureau by the producer of tonight's show, Carlotta Ribello. Carlotta, welcome to the show from all the way over there. We will start with the story being reported by local TV, CBS Local in Los Angeles. Bernie Sanders, one of increasing numbers of Americans who are running for president next year, has been in the vicinity.
Oh, yes, Bernie Sanders has been in town and everyone knows about it. So he was here yesterday joining thousands of union workers from the University of California who were taking part in this statewide strike calling for higher pay and better benefits. Now, what's interesting about this is, you know, it's Senator Bernie Sanders, also Democratic presidential candidate, who decided to briefly speak at the rally, one of the many that were taking place across the state as part of this statewide strike. And, you know, it is kind of very on brand for him. You might recall that just last summer he joined a similar rally, but this time it was the one of the Disneyland employees who were also protesting for higher wages. So I'm just wondering if from now on this will be where we'll find Bernie Sanders through strikes across across the country.
He probably won't want for audiences. Moving along to LA Mag, this is a really interesting color piece. It's one of those stories. It's the kind of story actually we like to do at Monocle Magazine, when you actually do a piece on people who actually just do a proper day's work and usually do it without much in the way of any attention being paid to them. And this is a search and rescue team attached to Los Angeles' firefighters who get sent all over the world to do what they do.
Exactly. I found this story quite fascinating. And now this is about the Urban Search and Rescue Task Force, which, as you point out, is part of the Los Angeles County Fire Department. Now, what makes this unit quite specific and interesting is that they are deployed to respond to disaster, mainly abroad. They do respond as well into some, of course, events in the United States. But, you know, if you just think the earthquake in Haiti in 2010 or the tsunami in Japan a year later, 9/11, or the earthquake in Nepal in 2015, this task force has also always been deployed whenever a different country calls for international help in a rescue and search operations. Now, it is important to note that this is an elite unit. We're talking about slightly over 200 men and women that collaborate with the U.S. military in these rescue and aid operations that are highly trained and specialized in different types of rescue, from swift water to hazmat and confined space as well. And yes, it's a really interesting piece on today's stories about this LA-based team that is putting out fires throughout the world.
Yeah, I recommend that one to our listeners if they've got time to look it up. It's a long-ish read. That's in LA Mag, the stories by Brandon Black. It's really, really interesting. Moving along to another story, this pertaining to Donald Trump's national emergency about the border and the sudden troop movements attending it. Now, I am not a four-star Marine Corps general, which is probably just as well, but even I could have guessed that this probably wasn't going to do wonders for the Marine Corps' combat readiness and ability to do things that actually, you know, matter. But a four-star Marine Corps general, indeed the Marine Corps Commandant, Robert Neller, does seem to have arrived at a similar view.
Oh, yes. He has warned the Pentagon, and this is an exclusive from the Los Angeles Times from today. He has sent a warning to the Pentagon that the deployments for this, as you said, Donald Trump's national emergency, because it seems like he's the only that believes this is happening to the southwest border, are undermining combat readiness of the Marines. And there's, of course, the issue of the transfers of funding that has to be diverted to, you know, address the emergency and to potentially build the wall that is not being used for planned military training. The article talks about a series of trainings that had to be cancelled in at least five countries, and also the delays to urgent repairs at different bases, mostly that have been damaged through hurricanes and disaster. Now, it's interesting here that they quote a couple of experts that have read the memo that Neller sent over to the Pentagon, and all of them agree that this is unusually harsh language, which just, you know, shows the extent, because we know he's not the sort of person that would, you know, he's very careful with the language used. And this just goes to show how really there's this other side and this consequence to the emergency emergency at the border that is actually affecting and undermining security within the United States.
Just finally then, and quite briskly if you could, because time is against us, but US News is looking into Los Angeles and its unfriendliness towards cyclists.
Yes, so I mean, getting to the city immediately, that becomes quite obvious how this is not a city this is not a Copenhagen, let's put it like that. Now, what's interesting about this story is that a couple of years ago, the mayor, Eric Grassetti, started this initiative, which was to, you know, get people to cycle more. But now, looking at the numbers, what is striking is not the amount of people that have taken up cycling, but actually how the number of pedestrian and cyclist deaths has increased. So there's a broader conversation to be had here in LA about perhaps education for drivers about how to share the road, more than actually getting people to, you know, exercise more and be more clean conscious, because the issue here doesn't seem to be getting people on two wheels, but making sure they reach the destination safely.
Carlotta Rebello in Los Angeles, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight, the acclaimed French filmmaker Christophe Honoré is the force behind the new film Sorry Angel. It's a semi-autobiographical story of a man suffering from the early stages of AIDS in Paris in the 1990s. Monocle's Ben Rylan met the stars of Sorry Angel, Pierre Deladonchamp and Vincent Lacoste, on the Cannes waterfront at last year's film festival. He started by asking Pierre about the intensity of the film's drama.
I felt like just I wanted to be on the set every day. I was right in place. I felt blessed to be in this movie, honored. And so I'm now proud to share it with people and proud to accompany Christophe Honoré in competition, because here it's like a window case for a movie to be shown. As soon as you go to Cannes, official competition, nobody watches the film the same way. So for us, it's a very big pride to be among the four French movies in competition and to be chosen among 1,900 movies that the committee saw. So that's what I feel.
And I heard you speaking in the press conference after the premiere, and you were speaking so highly of when you stepped on board the film, you really didn't have to think about it at all. You were happy to take the role. But I wonder, did you have any anticipation that it would receive the response that it has received here in Cannes? My impression is that when people saw this film, they really knew immediately that this was something quite profound that was being said here. Did you feel that way while you were making the film, or was it only after you saw the finished product that you started to really get an idea of what you'd taken part in?
Well, it's hard for me to be objective because I'm a huge fan of Honoré's work. I've watched almost all his movies. I love his movies. And it was a dream of mine to be in one of his movies one day. This is the perfect movie for me to be working with him. So I didn't know it would be in Cannes, but when I saw it 1.5 months ago, I didn't realize how good it was until I saw it again in Cannes, in the official screening, because it was okay. I saw myself once on screen. It's quite hard to see yourself on the screen. So this time was passed, and now I could just enjoy myself watching the movie a little bit more. So no, I didn't want to have any expectations on the movie. I just wanted Christophe to be happy with my work on it.
Vincent, you're quite a bit younger than, I suppose, some of the topics that are being depicted in the film. It can be quite difficult for young people to get to a point where they've got a good appreciation of just what it was like to be around, be that age, to be in your 20s or 30s when AIDS was first becoming a known thing. How conscious were you of the difficulty of really comprehending what it must have been like back then?
Well, actually, I was not really conscious of all of those stuff before shooting the movie. I mean, of course, I knew about AIDS. It had killed a lot of people, and it continues to do it. AIDS has always been present for my generation, but in a different way, because in France, for example, we don't die anymore of AIDS. I mean, less and less, and everybody has always used condom in his sexuality. It was quite interesting for me to be in front of that and of this period, especially with the point of view of Christophe, because my character is really inspired by Christophe's youth. And at that time, a lot of writers that he loved, like Hervé Guibert, Coltès, Lagarce, they all died actually in the beginning of the 90s, and the character of Jack is really inspired by them. He never had the chance, Christophe, to meet them and even to love them more through the years, because they died so young that he didn't have the time. He didn't want me to be like him at this period. I mean, my character is different than him. It's really inspired by him. But I'm not him in the movie, otherwise it would have been named Christophe. He let me imagine and create around the script a lot. He gave me a book to read, Beauty Lines of Alan Hollinghurst. He gave me two movies, Happy Together of Wong Kar-wai and My Own Private Idaho, Gus Van Sant. He gave me a perfume he used to wear when he was the age of my character. Otherwise, the look was really important for him too. He wanted to flat my hair and put me a little leather jacket. And he wanted the character to be really confident in his body and in his intelligence.
Pierre, your character can come across as quite pretentious, quite self-indulgent, but then I thought you did an excellent job of really humanizing him. And how aware were you of that line between the character being true to who he really was, a bit self-involved, but then also someone who had real empathy and real sympathy?
Actually, to be honest, I just had to follow the script, because everything was obvious that the character was gently going down in his life, but also realizing things and trying to be honest with the other character and try to say, well, this is like this, I'm like that, that's what I did. Maybe I thought, well, this man is becoming an adult. He decided to face the truth with himself, thanks to him, thanks to Arthur. That's what I felt, because he deserves it.
That was Pierre Deldon-Champ and Vincent Lacoste, stars of Sorry Angel, the new film by Christophe Honoré. They were speaking to Ben Ryland. Sorry Angel's out in cinemas in the UK and Ireland today. It's already on screens in the United States. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Ben Ryland and Carlotta Ribello. The researcher was Teresa Marvulli. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Ty Genwright is here 8 hours from now with The Globalist. The Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow, 2200 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.